Hi, everyone, and welcome to the inaugural Academic Life in Emergency Medicine, Journal of Graduate Medical Education, Hot Topics in Medical Education. This is an experiment for both of our organizations, and I think a really cool initiative. For the next 30 minutes, we have the principal investigator of a really neat study on the resident as teacher. We have a leading medical educator from the University of Chicago, and we have you who will be able to share questions and comments that you want to hear about this topic of what makes a great resident teacher. We have 30 minutes together. First, some quick introductions. My name is Jonathan Sherbino. I'm a clinician educator and emergency medicine physician at McMaster University. And with me, I have the lead author, Lindsay Melvin. Say hi, Lindsay.
Hi, everybody. I'm a PGY4 General Internal Medicine Fellow at the University of Toronto, and I did my core internal medicine at McMaster University.
Good to see you again. And we have Barrett Fromm. Say hi, Barrett.
Hi, gang. I'm Barrett Fromm. I'm a pediatric hospitalist from the University of Chicago, and I run our RAT program here.
And then hanging out in the background, we have the editor-in-chief of Academic Life in Emergency Medicine, Michelle Lin, and one of the co-editors, Nikki Joshi. They'll be kind of coordinating behind-the-scenes stuff, and if there's ideas or comments that come in via the intranets, they will direct them to us. I want to set up our talk by just giving a brief overview of how the study went. This was a survey of medical students on what they thought made great qualities and great teaching characteristics for resident teachers. It was done by designing a survey based on the literature, what the literature would suggest are good qualities, and then delivered to a series of medical students representing all the Ontario medical schools after they attended an internal medicine course that ran over the period of a weekend. So I was hoping maybe, Lindsay, based on that, you could walk us through some of the key findings in terms of what are great qualities and what are great teaching techniques used by resident teachers, and then contrast with things you thought were a little surprising in terms of your outcomes.
Sure, absolutely. So what we found when we surveyed the students is that when it comes to resident teaching techniques, the students really value the use of clinical examples, the repetition of sort of key points, and demonstration of techniques, really things that help define the key teaching points. The teaching techniques that were less valued, which we're going to talk about in today's chat a little bit, is feedback. The students really didn't rank feedback very highly compared to some of the other teaching techniques that we surveyed them on. And when it came to teacher qualities, we found that students really value educators who are aware of the student's level, who are able to tailor teaching to the level of the student, and who obviously have a strong knowledge base. And things that weren't valued, not so surprisingly, were serious teachers, or actually teachers who ask challenging probing questions. So maybe we can touch on that a little bit and see what everyone thinks about that finding.
I think that you've certainly provoked us a little bit with some of your findings, maybe not intuitively the results that we'd have anticipated. Let me bring in Barrett Fromm, kind of our expert analyst, running color play-by-play for us. Barrett, what do you think about these findings? Are there some global comments that you want to make around the results that Lindsay and her group discovered?
Yeah, so I think, Lindsay, great job on this study, because this is an area I love articles on RAT, mainly which we have to come up with a better name for, mainly because everything we've done to develop residents as teacher programs really has been based on a faculty model. I think you allude to that in your article. And we don't know if that's what residents need to learn compared to what a faculty member. So any piece of information we can get on really what is better to train our residents to be teachers is valuable. I think it's fascinating that you guys got that feedback. Although it's interesting, you know, feedback was rated as important, it's just the lowest of the ones you had listed. So it's not like they said it's horrible, it sucks. They said it's just comparatively not as important. So I don't want everyone to think that feedback was, please don't ever God give us feedback. But I think it is a fascinating piece when you comparatively talk about what we train residents to do and what we train faculty to do. I also like that you looked at techniques versus qualities. What is the quality of a great educator? Because that has been studied in faculty for a very long time. In fact, I did it in pediatric hospitalist educators. And I think there's some similarities with what we found before. But the techniques are really the unique aspect. And I think a lot of what they list are great what you've listed are great educational techniques when talking about making it relevant. It's learning theory, basically, some of the stuff you listed. So that's why I found it feedback to be missing is an interesting, I know we're going to discuss it, but an interesting point. But I think this definitely adds to the small dialogue that really has been done in the literature on specifically resident teaching.
Great. We've been talking online over the last 4 days, the Alium blog, the Twitter, and there's been a lot of questions that have been raised. I want to walk us through three questions that I think are most important and give an opportunity for people to kind of jump in as well. First is let's dig a little bit more into feedback. The finding that feedback wasn't ranked highly by medical students as a quality for resident teachers, a little controversial, doesn't align with what we'd assume would be best practices as medical educators, and maybe a bit incoherent with some of the other literature here. Barrett, you've given us a little bit of a taste as to what you think the explanation is, but Lindsay, I'm interested to hear your take first, and then we can maybe link in or loop in some of the comments that we've heard previously this week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Barrett touched on it a little bit. It's not that it was ranked really poorly. It comes out as that when you look at how everything else ranked quite a bit higher, but when you look at how the breakdown was, still a good number of students ranked feedback as highly useful. And when I went back and compared sort of the proportion of senior medical students versus more junior, all of our medical student attendees were either just about to enter clerkship or senior, and some of them were more senior than others. The breakdown actually mirrors what we see with who responded about feedback. We didn't track individual respondents and we didn't do a subgroup analysis, but the proportion is roughly similar. So in my mind, I wonder if some of the more senior medical students are the ones that responded as feedback being really highly useful, and if some of the more junior medical students either misinterpreted what's meant by feedback, and I think the lack of explanations around some of our descriptors might have had something to do with that, or don't yet know the value of feedback from residents. And I think that that's, when I look at that, the finding that we had, I don't think that feedback is should be thrown out, anything like that, but I think that what we're seeing is maybe some of the more senior medical students saw that that was more valuable than maybe some of the juniors.
Barrett, one of the themes I've come from the online discussion is that maybe residents don't label their feedback as feedback, and maybe medical students don't know feedback when they see it. Is it a question of labeling?
I think it's two things. I loved that discussion on the blog. This is not specific to residents. There's data that says faculty don't label it, and when faculty don't label it, then they don't know they're getting it. So we are all, if you go to a lot of teaching seminars, we're told to say, let me give you some feedback. And it's that statement that triggers it. Similarly, we're supposed to say, let me teach you something, or let me make a teaching point. And that tells you we're teaching. I also thought what was interesting, and I think Lindsay gets at it with her, though there wasn't a subgroup analysis, the potential. I noticed, Lindsay, correct me if I'm wrong, but 10% of the answer to that question said not applicable, which,
yep.
I felt like it was almost people saying, it's not applicable. Residents don't give feedback.
Right.
So I wondered if there is an essence in this group that hadn't gone on clerkships yet, and some people just thinking they don't think it's a resident role, and because of that, don't rank it highly, when maybe some know going in are more of the senior ones. So I think it's twofold. I think possibly it's within the group of the study, and how much do they understand the role of a resident, and what they are expecting them to do. And also that we label. I think the number one thing any educator can do is label what they're doing, whether it's teaching or whether it's giving feedback. Those are just easy sentences that start. I just had a meeting where we talked about how chairmen should label, let me give you feedback, to their faculty. It's the same on every level. So I think there's an understanding of what feedback is. And I think, Lindsay, you hinted at this too, feedback versus evaluation. They may think residents don't give feedback because residents don't fill out evaluations necessarily. And they're two totally different things, but I think our learners and even faculty don't understand the difference sometimes.
So that's an interesting idea. I guess what you're suggesting is if I use the word, let me give you some feedback, I'm halfway through to winning a teaching award. Is that about right?
I think you're three-quarters of the way through. Yeah, okay. And then just laugh a lot and you're set.
Smile.
Buy pizza. So, Lindsay, I have a question for you. One of the other takes on your finding is perhaps we use feedback to, in an internal way, to validate ourselves. We want feedback that says, you know what, you're doing okay, you're doing well. But there's a discongruence when we hear feedback that says you're not necessarily meeting the mark. You're in an interesting position. You're a senior resident. You do lots of teaching. But you're also receiving a lot of feedback regularly from faculty. What's your thought on that take?
I think very much so. I think when you have a medical student population, they're very type A, they're very eager to please, and everyone wants to be the best. And when it comes to feedback, sometimes that can not be as perfect, and the goal of feedback is really to improve on a skill or improve on some sort of observed, hopefully, encounter. And I think with medical students, they really value when it comes from faculty because that's the be-all and end-all, and that those are the people who matter. And I think sometimes in this way, way, you wonder if the medical students don't want or don't value the feedback from residents as highly because it maybe doesn't matter as much to them because the resident isn't who the medical student is trying to impress. Although I've met a number of medical students, and certainly from the Twitter discussion, we see that medical students certainly do value the help and the coaching they get from residents, and there's a bit of a language clarification, I think, that sometimes students tend to equate feedback with evaluation, and when it's coming from a resident, then they're not sure what to do with it or don't want to hear it if the resident's not responsible for their evaluation in the end.
Great. I want to transition us from this question of feedback to a question of how do you balance the needs when you design a curriculum. If you're going to design the perfect resident as teacher curriculum, Lindsay, you've identified the teaching techniques that the users would say are important. Historically, we've always looked at, well, we're not as interested in what the users want. We're interested in designing based on what we think the education theory has. So what's that balance between the perceived needs of the user and the observed needs of the so-called experts? How do you mix those two components together?
I think it's an interesting dilemma you face because I don't think medical students necessarily know what they need. And I know when I, and that's very personal on my account, when I look back, it's sure, you know, you want to be in situations that are comfortable with approachable teachers, but it's the moments when you're actually being challenged and sometimes when you're a little bit scared in a safe way that you learn the most. And I think that as educators, we have a responsibility to design curriculum that addresses all facets of education, and that's not always going to make someone happy. That's not always going to be the easiest way to do things or necessarily meet exactly what a student wants, but I think the literature does speak very well to this, that students don't always know what they want, and I'm sure residents are the same group. Residents don't always know what they want, and so when you're designing a resident as teacher curricula, you have to match what we need with making the end user happy.
What's your take, Barrett, on the same question?
I like Lindsay's comment. We always say, don't let the inmates run the asylum. We would never build anything that just looked at the student and said, hey, what do you want? Because if you'd asked me that when I was a medical student, I would say, tell me only pediatric things, don't tell me anything else. You can't let that happen. I think a model of framing this is, there's a book called Kern's Six Steps for Medical Education, Curriculum Development, something like that. And one of the steps is identifying the problem and identifying your stakeholders. And I think thinking of stakeholders is essential in this. Rather than thinking of experts versus residents or students, it's stakeholders. Students are stakeholders, obviously. So it's important what they think. They're on the ground. They've seen what works. They've seen what hasn't. And that's a key piece. Residents are essential, right? Because a student could say, I want residents to teach me by lecture for 5 hours a day, and we'd all laugh, because that's not going to happen. So how do residents think it's best? They've also had the experience of being students. But certainly the faculty who have taught and taught teaching and have done research in this area are valuable. One could even look to patients as a stakeholder if you wanted to see how teaching can interfere or aid in their hospital stay or in their encounter. I think of clinics. That's one place where teaching can occur. So I think framing this as stakeholders, thinking of the stakeholders and the stakeholder needs, and whether that's through more studies like this or focus groups or interviews or anything like that, that will, I think, definitely feed your ability to set your goals and objectives for your curriculum and then move forward into a residence as teacher curriculum that's ideal.
I want to spin this question a little bit to the left. So we have the current generation or millennials. As a culture, are there any features that make them as stakeholders unique in that as a Gen X member, do I need to be aware of some of my perceptions or my perceived biases? Either of you have a thought on that?
I definitely think it does. I think the generation that we see coming through right now, we have to engage them a little bit differently than even I was engaged as a medical student. To me, that is predominantly on the technology front. There's so much to be done in medicine and technology, and I think using Twitter and this is a great example, but engaging students on all fronts, because that's where they're going, that's their resources, that's what they use on a daily basis. And so when we talk about teaching residents and teaching students, I think that using technology is probably the biggest gap when we talk about generations that came before them.
Yeah, I think there's also a piece to, I won't call it the millennials, it's almost the millennials in medical education, in the sense that you're seeing a lot of changes within residency programs about how we group our conferences. Rather than every day there's a noon conference, now we're doing academic half days. Those changes, not necessarily with the individuals, but with how the individuals are getting their education, also has to be taken into account when you plan these things. So not only the individual generational differences, but almost the education generational differences of how we're doing education all come into play in how you deliver.
process.
Interesting. The third question I want to move us to is, in a perfect world with all the money that you had, Lindsay, any wishes about how you might design your study differently? Or the way to ask the same question is, every study has a limitation. There is issues of feasibility all the time. What are some of the issues that you identified as a limitation to your study, and what are the next steps that you would like to take this whole research question forward with?
I definitely learned a lot from doing this, and one of the big things I learned about study design is the limitations of doing something after the fact, and certainly we did this after a conference, and the conference featured a lot of residents as teachers. And while that was great, and the conference itself was fantastic, and having that many medical students in one place from all different institutions was sort of why we capitalized on it, to me, it really limited our generalizability and the results, because we were constantly questioning, you know, are we getting these answers, because it's a post-conference situation. And so in future, I would have liked to repeat the study in a more prospective way, looking at maybe more generalized group of students who aren't only there because they're interested in internal medicine, though I think the findings probably would generalize across. I think it's worth repeating in a more broad sense, and I think that was one of the big things that I took away from doing the study and the big things I learned from it.
So Barrett, it's easy for us to be armchair quarterbacks. We didn't have to do the hard legwork of getting the data. What do you think about these issues around recall bias or opportunistic sampling that limit the generalizability of the findings?
I think it's interesting. I love that you had a captive audience and you took advantage of that, which is fantastic. And that's one of the biggest issues in research, is getting people to participate and cooperate and do what you want them to do. But there, obviously, you know, Lindsay's already pointed out, there's some issues with recall bias. There's a really interesting study from Bhutani, I think, last year, 2013, so 2 years ago, a medical teacher, where they did just pediatrics, just inpatient teaching. And what they actually did was they did focus groups at the outset of a clerkship and at the end of the clerkship, as well as resident focus groups. And so they took that into account to say, you're coming in, what do you think? Now you're leaving. What do you think? And so there are ways to get around that. Let's be honest, there's no one way to do this, right? There's no one way to skin a cat. There's survey design versus qualitative focus groups and interviews. There's doing it in a situation like this where you've got a lot of people from across Ontario in different schools in that area versus the national versus one site with a little bit more robust multiple measures. It's a good study in that we did what we could, but there's definitely... this could be followed up with a qualitative piece, because we don't understand what they meant by feedback. And that would also add to some of the depth of what you have. You know, you see a lot of mixed method studies. You don't see a lot, but you're seeing more mixed method studies for just that reason. So I think there are some issues to armchair it, but I think getting the preliminary data now, I always think of my first study is the one that launches the second one that makes it even more robust.
So Lindsay, where are you going from here? How are you taking your hypothesis generation that's come out of your study, and what would you like, assuming that you have all the time in the world and you're not busily trying to finish up your own residency training, where would you take this whole next step in your study of what makes a great resident teacher?
I think I'd like to refine the concepts a little bit more and refine more about how we execute this, how residents as teachers execute this on a day-to-day basis, and look at transitioning that into clinical practice and finding those teaching moments. And I've been involved with some endeavors at MAC that work with residents as teachers and try and optimize the daily moments that we have into teaching moments and translating it into the resident as teacher role. And that's something I'm really looking at in the future for not just students in internal medicine, but students in general at the resident level, to turn the residents into more comfortable teachers, because I think that's one of the things we find is residents just become teachers. And so part of this work is to inform them as to what students are looking for and what they can do, and working on that, really.
Well, thanks, Lindsay. I'm not sure if you know what the first rule of the internet is, but anything you say here, you have to do and live up to no matter what, with no kind of change. Lots of interesting opportunities for you to move forward with. The final comment is, rather than a question, maybe a comment. Barrett, maybe you could tell us about some of the resources that you're working on. One of the challenges I think we have as an education community is we have this perpetual desire to reinvent the wheel. We work very much in silos, and we don't share as broadly as we can. I think with this new age of social media, we have that ability to kind of interact and touch different communities by sharing what we're using, so that we don't have to develop our own idiosyncratic resident as teacher curriculum and then replicate that across the country and around the world. I'm interested to hear a little bit about what's already being built, and maybe you can tell us about the project you're working on.
Sure. I agree with you. I've been doing this for resident as teacher probably for 14 years, and I built it originally off of a three-part workshop handbook that the American Academy of Pediatrics put out, and then I just evolved from there. But there's so many amazing things that are out there, and a lot of them aren't published because you just build them and you do them, and maybe you don't get your outcome, so you're not going to publish them in a paper. I think some resources always, I just actually looked last night, if you go to the AAMC MedEd portal, has a handful of residents as teacher curricula that are on there that will have teacher's guides. I think I saw four or five off a quick search. iCollaborative is also on the AAMC. If you don't know the difference, MedEd portal is peer-reviewed and takes a little while to get published. It has a little bit of work to do it. iCollaborative, as long as there's not a copyright issue, you can post any piece of curriculum you have up there and people can grab it down. The problem with that is it's sometimes hard to find what you want. Knowing that we want people to be able to just grab. There are a lot of small programs. There are a lot of programs that have young people who don't know how to build this but want to do it. I think it's important that we all share. And right now I'm working with the Academic Pediatric Association to build a website that is a repository for RAT curricula. It is not specific to pediatrics. Any curricula can go. We started by pulling a handful. We published a paper recently on the RAT curricula that are published, and we rated them for reproducibility. Could you just grab it and do it? And for level of Kirkpatrick outcome, how high was the level of outcome that you had gotten. And we found a select group that we're going to be able to post onto that website with the author's permission. But we're actually looking for anybody to submit to our website. What it's going to be is a little bit easier than MedEd Portal to submit because it's not going to be quite the thickness of peer review, but it's going to be a little bit better than iCollaborative because it's going to be very specific to residents as teacher. That's the only kind of curricula we'll have there. We're going to assign scores, so you, if you're the user, can go say, oh, this one had really good outcomes, but it's partly reproducible without making a call to the author. And we're also going to classify them by, do you need a workshop? Do you need a half-day module? Do you need a one-hour lecture? Are you a small program, a large program? Are you looking for pediatrics? Are you looking for internal medicine? And so we're really excited that the Academic Pediatric Association has given us the platform to do that. And we should be going live in the next, I would say, 8 weeks. So if anyone does have a curricula that they would like to submit, I'm taking donations currently. We'll also have a way by we're going to give submitters annual data on how many people have pulled down their data, so it will help with teaching portfolios. But I think anything, we now have the tech on websites to be able to do this. Elizabeth Morrison years ago, probably 15 years ago, had a website that anyone could post, but it's not like the tech we have now. And so we can classify, we can sort, we can search, we can do a lot of different things, and I think that's the next step for RAT.
Great. So for everyone who's listening and following along at home, all these details and how you can contribute to this free open access medical education repository, you can find the details at the ALEM blog. Additionally, there is a number of other crowdsourced resources that you might want to find there. And more importantly, if you have something you think is amazing, don't keep it just to yourself. Why don't you share it so that its impact can move beyond your home program and have an influence more broadly within the health professional education community. We're almost at our time limit here. Lindsay, I'm going to give you final thoughts of anything you want to kind of share, any final message that you think is important that's come from your research.
I think we've chatted about all the interesting findings. I just wanted to thank everyone out there who read the paper and who got engaged with it and has been talking about it on Twitter. I think when we started this study and we went through the publication process, as anybody can attest to, but as a resident, it was really daunting, and I had great support in Hamilton. And when we actually did this, the hope was that people would read it, but I don't think we ever imagined that this many people would be reading it and talking about it. So we really appreciate it. And anybody who wants to chat about it more, please tweet at me. I try to answer as soon as I can. And my Twitter handle is attached to any number of these, and we'll make sure it's available after this.
Barrett?
Yeah, the one thing I would say that I think about coming out of this is, as you said, it takes us out of our silos. We're talking pediatrics, internal medicine, emergency medicine. Through things like this, meet collaborators. Because, you know, Lindsay did it one place, but now maybe Lindsay and I talk and we do something across countries, so in that sense, across specialties. Find your collaborators nationally, because that is going to make everything more generalizable. And clearly by this article and by looking at it, easy lit cert, we need more information to understand and change the model of training residents to teach than we've seen before.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us. I think this has been a really important and insightful chat that we've had today. For everyone else, I want to encourage you to comment on what you've seen here. We'll keep the blog open for one more day, and then we're going to curate it. I hope you will all check out Lindsay's publication in one of the spring issues of the Journal of Graduate Medical Education. As a companion piece, we are collating this virtual discussion that we've had over the last week. identifying some of the key themes, some of the resources, and some of the important points as a reflective commentary based on her work. So also look for that as an accompanying manuscript in one of the spring issues of the Journal of Graduate Medical Education. I direct you back to the academiclifeandemergencymedicine.com blog, where you can share comments and insights, or if you want to reach us via Twitter, it's hashtag JGME Scholar. I want to thank Nikki Joshi, who's been providing a lot of questions to us from the internets, and to Michelle Lin, the editor-in-chief at Alium, for kind of coordinating everything. I'm Jonathan Sherboneau, and thanks for listening.